Hi, and welcome to the Provider Podcast. I'm Susan Barr, and on today's episode, we're talking about the importance of integrating mental health services within their surrounding community. This is a really timely episode, with World Mental Health Day taking place just 2 days ago on October the 10th. This year's theme, mental health is a universal human right, something we'll discuss later in the episode. Kicking us off this week, I spoke to our Deputy Chief Executive, Saffron Cordery, about the actions needed to help destigmatise mental health and how services can be improved. I began by asking her what key issues mental health chief execs are raising with her at the moment.
I think what we are seeing at the moment is the same theme that we have seen over the last couple of years, really, which is that there is a huge level of demand for mental health services, and the waiting lists for mental health services are really growing. So what we're not seeing is that big focus on how we actually get the waiting times down for mental health services and how we actually do something about demand.
And Saffron, is there anything that could be done better to meet the needs of people who are waiting to get help with their mental ill health? And what else could the government do and other kind of national NHS leaders to tackle the pressure mental health services are facing?
The thing that we need to identify in mental health is that we operate with a pre-existing level of unmet needs, which is completely unacceptable, of course. But it does indicate that there is a basic level of difference of treatment. So the first thing we need to do is make sure that there is a real equity between mental health and physical health in terms of how we tackle it. I think we also need some significant government action on mental health across the piece. So we were expecting the government to publish a long-term cross-governmental plan for mental health and wellbeing, but instead this plan has been subsumed and now it will be part of one of the six conditions that's covered in the major conditions strategy. We're expecting that to be published early next year. It's good that the issue hasn't been dropped altogether. It does really take the focus away from the kind of holistic approach to mental health. And there isn't that much focus in the major conditions strategy on integrating mental and physical health or integrating different conditions and how we treat them. So I think that that's a little bit of a missed opportunity from government. Also, and disappointingly, we think it's very unlikely that in the King's speech that we're expecting before Christmas, that we will actually see the legislation be discussed around reforming the Mental Health Act. You know, it's legislation that's really, really important, but it's more than 40 years old and it really needs to be updated. But what we're seeing is that now being pushed to one side to make way for other legislative priorities. And that's deeply disappointing.
See, it sounds like there have been kind of various missed opportunities there to really put a strong focus on mental health. Do you think that mental health is still enough of a priority either for this government or whoever forms the next government?
I think that sadly, we have seen the focus slip away from mental health in political terms, whether it's from the government or across the political landscape. And I think that we have to remember that to take significant action on mental health, it isn't just saying the words mental health is important. It's actually building it in structurally into how you deliver services, how you commission services, how you pay for services, and where you consider the priority to lie. And I think that, you know, we've seen, for example, in decisions around capital investment in particular, a real sense that mental health needs aren't being put at the top of the list or even near the top of the list. And the one thing we know that matters hugely to those who are suffering from mental illnesses is that being able to be treated, whether as an inpatient or whether in the community, in an environment which is therapeutic, that means state-of-the-art buildings which are fit for purpose, is absolutely critical. So even things like capital investment and how we invest our money in the bricks and mortar has a knock-on effect. And I think that the big thing I would say is that there's a lot of talk about mental health, but I think that what we don't see is that real focus in particular on kind of severe and enduring mental ill health.
Zafran, you touched upon the condition of the mental health estate, and we know that there is a huge maintenance backlog. What else does the mental health sector want to see in terms of the estate and its development? Because we know that that's been in the news a lot recently.
I think we absolutely need to see mental health estate moving up the priority list for systems, for NHS England nationally, for the government, and to see that investment in a way that genuinely meets the needs of mental health patients and the services that they have to use. Because what we know is that there is a huge amount of backlog, whether we're talking about things like dormitory wards, whether we're talking about getting rid of ligatures, whether we're talking about reforming and transforming different bits of the estate that are just frankly dangerous and not fit for purpose, or whether we're talking about improving something so that a ward, for example, isn't a series of tiny rooms where no one can be seen, but is actually more open plan, where people have the ability to mix with each other effectively or to be on their own in an environment that is frankly nice. Because after all, the length of stay in mental health services is typically much longer than it is in physical health services. And, you know, the provision needs to be equally as good. The environment is therapeutic. And if it's a poor environment, people aren't going to get as well as quickly.
So turning towards World Mental Health Day, the theme this year is that mental health is a universal human right. Timely, but we know that those with severe and enduring mental illnesses aren't always given the focus they deserve. And stigma remains more so than for people with milder to moderate mental ill health. I suppose my question to you, Zafran, is what more could be done to ensure we tackle stigma for these individuals and ensure they get the support that they need?
Tackling the stigma is absolutely fundamental if we are going to continue to speak up on behalf of everyone who needs to access a really good and effective mental health service. Because if we don't, we aren't going to be able to help people actually access the mental health services they need to be able to exercise that universal human right, which is good mental health. So it's so important that we demystify, that we kind of take the taboo out of talking about mental illness, that we understand that it feels like a cliche now to say one in four people experience mental ill health, but we know it's the case, and we know that it's way more common than anyone wants to talk about. And so it's only by talking and understanding the needs more effectively and actually taking steps to build in support for mental health services structurally that we will actually bring about that kind of destigmatization. Because at the moment, what we are seeing is a narrative on the one hand, but it isn't matched by action. And that's what we've got to overcome.
We were talking earlier about whether mental health was still enough of a priority for either the current government or whoever forms the next one. So Zafran, we're obviously kind of heading towards a general election. What would you like to see in the various party manifestos with regards to mental health?
I want to see absolutely explicit measures and proposals with investment attached to them that delivers that structural equity between mental and physical health provision. Because without that, we aren't going to be able to take the strides that we need to take.
Zafran Caudry there. Next, on to our case study. And we visited Southwest London and St George's Mental Health Trust. We were lucky enough to visit that new development site, Springfield Village, which is aiming to transform mental health services in the community, eliminate the stigma of mental health, and provide people with the right care at the right time in the right place. I began by speaking to Anne Beasley, their chair, and Ian Garlington, their integrated project director, about their local demographics, the drivers behind their ambitions, and what these ambitions mean for their community.
Here in Southwest London, we serve a really diverse community. 35% of people in our local communities are from minority ethnic backgrounds. I think the national average is about 20%. And that's also reflected in our workforce. Something like half of our workforce are Black, Asian and minority ethnic. But we know that there are inequalities in access, experience and outcomes. when it comes to mental health care for people from minority ethnic backgrounds. Black people, 4 times more likely to be detained under the Mental Health Act than white people. People from minority ethnic backgrounds, much higher risk of developing a mental health problem in adulthood, and twice as likely to experience common mental health issues in any given week compared to white people. And despite these proportions, people from ethnic minorities are less likely to receive support for their mental health, with underrepresentation in access to talking therapies and overrepresentation in inpatient settings. So there are structural inequalities and structural racism underpinning this. One of the important things that we've done is we've been working with a partner, a local community group called the Wandsworth Community Empowerment Network, to try and improve, we call it our Ethnicity and Mental Health Improvement Project, to tackle these health inequalities, and we're trying to be anti-racist in everything we do. And by that I mean we're not just assuming by default that things aren't racist, but we're actively looking to check that they're not. But in this improvement project, we've identified 4 different work streams that we think will start to get into some of these health inequalities. So we've been working with local community groups to set up mental health and well-being hubs in the community. And these are places where people would ordinarily go, but now they can go and find a safe space to get information, to have physical health checks, or to be signposted for further support. Importantly, given the disproportionate number of young black men on our wards, we've been looking to reduce the restricted practices and coercion, because we know there has been disproportionality. And what we're trying to do is for our black and minority ethnic patients to identify a friend or a family member who can be part of the discussion about treatment and try and avoid the use of force. We've started to pilot that, and I think that's a really important initiative. And finally, we're thinking about how do we create a culturally capable workforce so that people are much more sensitive to the needs, to individuals' cultural backgrounds in their mental health journey and recovery.
The NHS estate and the condition of the mental health estate has obviously been in the news recently. You've gone through a huge transformation project to create Springfield Village. Can you take our listeners through how patient care services and the estate have changed and the impact this will have on patients and their families?
I'd be absolutely delighted to. And we're thrilled that you've come and done the tour with us today. But the important part there is we started off doing an estates-based programme, and we were incredibly fortunate to have a large walled asylum historically that we were custodians of. And what we had the vision of, and it's taken 2 decades to bring this forward, but the vision of being able to create the new Springfield Village, which is a mixed-use complex of mental health at its heart, 2 new inpatient units serving both forensic and non-forensic patients and our outpatient services as well. But most importantly, new homes, more than 800 new homes. That's populations of more than 3,000 people. 5 commercial outlets that support both our patient population, our staff population, but also the new neighbours that we have with us now, shops that they can go to. It helps support our green agenda by reducing reliance on car transport. And importantly, whereas in the community, people used to walk around us, around the literal wall for us, we now encourage them to come through and with us, because that's really important to our anti-stigma agenda that we're trying to now make people see this amazing facility that we have. But it's not about the hospitals, it's about the village that we pull together. But the interesting part of your question was the second part around the patient outcomes. What we've started to do, we're 6 months in now to having our inpatient wards live in our new Trinity Hospital. And what we hear are some surprising feedback. I don't think it'll be a surprise to you or to our listeners that nobody wants to be in hospital. That it's the last place anyone wants to be. That's not that if you're unwell, hospital isn't the right place for you. But when you're here, it can be a really traumatic time, no matter how great the facilities are. We use our lived experience network of move makers to go and talk with our inpatient people. They've collected comments like, do you know what, when my family come to visit me, I feel less anxious because they now walk through a normal street and they come into a healthcare facility where we've got some amazing family-friendly facilities where I can see my niece, nephew, son, daughter, loved one in a place that doesn't feel that they are instantaneously exposed to the very stark reality of our inpatient environments. And that's really quite amazing. And it's important now that we started to think about wellness. So we're great at fixing, but what we've realised that we've actually developed now is this ability to really support our communities in mental wellness. And that's been a genuine revelation to us. And we're activating that new population, that new village community, into being supporters of us and with us. Why is that important? Because that's the reduction in stigma that comes along. We're not a walled, scary institution where goodness knows what happens behind it. We're part of the people who are behind you in the queue in Tesco's. We're part of the community on the bus that goes on. And it's really super.
But another part of our vision is about how do you create a South West London that is compassionate and understanding. So another initiative, which I think, again, we're very proud of, is called the South London Listens. We're working with the three mental health trusts across South London. And when the pandemic hit, we launched the South London Listens programme, and we worked with fabulous organisation, Citizens UK. We talked to 6,000 people, lots of groups, and we asked those groups what would help. And they came up with four main ideas. One was around setting up Be Well hubs in community groups. And the important thing there is, again, you are getting into groups where people naturally congregate. And it might be around a hobby, it might be around religion, it might be around a school. But actually creating an environment where people will go, where they can talk about their mental well-being. And partly what Ian's saying, it's part of this, actually, if your friend who joins your hobby group with you says, do you know you can get help for mental health, and this is where you go, it's all part of destigmatising it. But I think importantly, and of course this is really relevant in the current climate, we kind of understand that poverty is a big driver of poor mental health, and we were able to get a commitment that all employers, local authorities, NHS trusts would commit to the London Living Wage. And that's really important. So there's a sort of absolutely everywhere. If we can create this environment that makes it a good place to live, and then more accessible, shorter waiting times in services, fewer people going on to inpatient settings. But as Ian says, if you need to go into an inpatient settings, and sometimes that's right, we want that to be a really therapeutic experience.
So as well as ambitious changes to your acute services, there's also been a huge amount of work done on community services to help people with serious mental illness stay well amongst their friends and family. One of the areas I'd really like to focus on is the Sutton Uplift Mental Health and Wellbeing Hub and the push that there is no wrong door into your services. Can you tell us more about that?
You're right. Do you know what? Of our the people that engage with our services, in broad terms, if we had around 47,000 contacts in the last 12 months, about 1,500 of those contacts were in an inpatient setting. We provide services across five boroughs of South West London. And we used Sutton as our first pilot borough that we went in. We did the co-production piece that started to look at what is it that people want from our services. And we talked to them in a vast amount of workshops around how we could improve services. What people want isn't always what people need. And we bring that repackage of services so that we give a really great product to people and see outcomes which are supporting people in our community. And you're right, do you know what? There is no wrong door into our services. It doesn't matter where you come into it now in the Sutton single point of access. You will always end up getting the right mix of that whole community offer, from VCSE partners to statutory organisations like ourselves, acting on your behalf.
The early evidence is that the waiting times are coming down, which actually is kind of what we're trying to achieve. The other thing I would say is one of the things that we're really keen to do, this is part of us being an anchor institution, is we're trying to create roles that people in our communities can do. There aren't enough registered mental health nurses in the country. But if we can find roles that we can equip local people to do, A, it gives them jobs, but but also they're likely to stay with us, which again is something that's kind of win-win.
And moving on to a different topic. So as part of our tour, we saw some amazing artwork on the walls within your village, and art features really strongly across your new estate. Can you tell us how the relationship with Hospital Rooms Charity came about, and what kind of reaction and feedback you've had from service users, families and the community?
It's well discussed and researched that great views, artwork and therapeutic spaces all aid both physical and mental health recovery times for patients in our in-services. That's not disputed. What we've done on this journey, and Hospital Rooms were instrumental in both helping us raise charitable funds to do this, but also in then curating a programme which engaged more than 120 workshops that were run by 20 artists. And when we're talking about artists here, we're talking about artists, some of them have work hanging in the Tate Modern. You know, this is not local amateur art that goes on, but they curated workshops with our lived experience network, with our staff, with the community. The important thing about that is they all have a significance. The important thing is every time one of those clients comes back as a lived experience network, they can see their fingerprints on the building. And the other thing then is it gives us an opportunity to talk about the anti-stigma agenda that we have in mental health by talking about art. And art is another channel to talking to both philanthropic organisations, to different media outlets, and it all helps us to talk about the context that we've got here at Springfield and how actually it's changing the culture of a local community to be far more inclusive. And all of these things, all of that journey from outside to inside, is part of settling you in to having a great healthcare experience. So that's why art's important, but Hospital Rooms instrumental with us.
I was just going to add just the importance of environment. And one of the things that we haven't talked about is that we've designed all of our inpatient wards to all have safe access to a green space. And that's incredibly important for patients' well-being. But we also have a fantastic public park. And it's lovely to walk through it and see the community mixing with our patients, service users, walking through the park.
Ian, you've obviously seen a lot of transformation building projects in your time in the NHS. What reflections do you want to share with any other trusts who are thinking of getting a new build? And is there anything you'd have done differently if you knew then what you know now?
The first thing to say is that we're constantly learning. We're constantly understanding the built environment. And it's not about the space in the buildings. It's about the spaces between the buildings. They're the areas that form the culture of what we want to do. You know, Anne was talking earlier on about the open spaces in the parkland. And I think that the experience that I would take from Springfield, you know, Anne is chair of our board, has administered a really brave board in getting us to where we are, around the decisions that we've made corporately about how we've been able to progress the scheme forward. But also latterly, being able to embrace what it is we've created and then some vision about actually we've created far more than what we thought we were set out to do. So in the park, we had to create and hand back a park. But what we were able to do was then, with our renewed lens of an anchor institution that we put onto that, and with the support of a progressive board, we were able to look at it and say, I wonder what would happen if we could hold that park in a different way. I wonder what would happen if we had a social enterprise style vehicle that could administer the administration of that park into the future. I wonder if that meant that rather than just cutting the grass and pruning the trees, we could start to think about supporting people with lived experience to get that first paid job on a CV, which allows them to have an opportunity at a London Living Wage, we heard Anne talk about that earlier on, to actually then change their life chances going forward and give them an opportunity to have a career, to have work, to have a home, to work on all of those benefits that we know from the wider determinants of health, bring forward a successful and thriving community. If only we changed the way we held that park and did it that way. And do you know what? Really chuffed to tell you that we have. We've now got permission, working with our colleagues in the London Borough of Wandsworth, that we are going to do that. We are going to hold that park in that new and innovative way. But that's just one example of where, if we hadn't stepped into a space that no one saw existed, then the space between our buildings wouldn't be the space that it's going to be. And that's the defining experience of why this is such a amazing opportunity for everyone who works and orbits around this great development.
And do you have any other reflections as chair?
When we first had the business case approved, we had a board development session on how to manage the building of a hospital. And we were described by the management consultant that was working with us as accidental developers. And it was kind of, that's what we thought we were doing. You know, we were going to build, well, we were going to work with our partners to oversee the building. And we thought that was scary enough. And then actually we just took it for granted. And, you know, we described, well, it never occurred to us that the hospital wouldn't be built. And there were all these other opportunities. So I think my advice to others is to be brave, and not reckless, but brave, to think the possible and go for it.
So Ian, we've talked a lot about anchor institutions. So what does that mean for listeners who might not know what an anchor institution is?
Now that's a great question, because actually it can sound an awful lot like a theoretical thing that comes forward, isn't it? And again, the long-term plan gives us that signpost to why being an anchor, being a large employer within our communities who are stable through economic cycles, is what an anchor is. And there's a spin on it that says there are some things that you think and would expect us to do. So can we procure things locally? Can we support local companies rather than looking at maybe best price from a national contract? Could it be a good value price locally, but actually supporting the wellness of our local economy has much wider social value than it does fiscal value? So we get that. That's kind of feels like, you know, the rubber's on the road on that one already. What we've done here, though, is we've really started to think hard and ask ourselves the question, if we were doing this as an anchor, what would we do more? And it's kind of, I can tell you that we're spending £250 million building new healthcare facilities in Southwest London. But what actually we're doing as an anchor is we're facilitating more than £1 billion worth of activity in Southwest London by regenerating surplus land that we had to create great healthcare, but more than that, to provide, you know, when we finish our construction processes, more than 7 years worth of construction activity in there, housing stock that will last for generations. We've been able to actually influence how we've disposed of that land, to influence how much of that housing comes forward is affordable housing, allowing people to live and thrive in a community that they've been brought up in, which economically they may not be able to stay in if we didn't bring forward great affordable housing. I'm super pleased to be able to tell you that we're hopeful that we're going to get our next release of land, which will have 50% affordable, of which 50% of that 50% will be affordable rents. Now, that's the only scheme I'm aware of in London that's meeting that target on the way through. That's remarkable, and I'm super proud of the knock-on effects that we will provide to the community in and around Springfield Village, Tolworth in Kingston, and our other sites as we work through.
And what's next for the Trust in terms of your redevelopment plans and looking to the future?
Well, it doesn't just stop at Springfield. I know we've been waxing on about that rather a lot. We've been really lucky that we've already had the business case approved for the redevelopment of Barnes Hospital, another great use hospital where we've got new housing going on. We're working with the Department of Education to bring on an SEN school as part of that development to complement our health hub that goes at Barnes. Great partnership working and really needed on there. That's also, at the moment, we're on site at the former Richmond Royal Hospital, where we're creating, again, 70 new residential units, but also a new health hub. That's going to be delivered next year in 2024. And then earlier on this year, Anne presided over a board meeting that approved the £100 million redevelopment of our Tolworth Hospital in Kingston. And that's now been supported by external colleagues as we go through the final approval processes. And we hope to break ground on that in the new calendar year as well. So, you know, our transformation projects carrying on. But again, just to emphasise for listeners, we're creating new environments for greater community engagement. And actually the value that we're creating, the social value that we're putting back in now, is far greater than the commercial investment appraisal within the business case suggests it is. And we're now realising that through the lens of anchor, of how much and how important and instrumental we are to the wellness of our populations around us. And anyone listening who would like to come down and experience the Springfield experience should absolutely come and see us. So please, colleagues listening in, do get in touch.
Anne Beasley and Ian Garlington sharing the ins and outs of their fantastic redevelopment project and highlighting the importance of integrating mental health services within their community. So that's it for this week. Thank you to all our guests for their contributions, and be sure to check out Springfield Village as it continues to grow. A reminder, you can join in the conversation by following us on X, formerly known as Twitter, and LinkedIn at NHS Providers with the hashtag The Provider Podcast to keep up to date on future episodes by subscribing to the podcast. Thank you for listening.